Welcome to the World War I History Podcast, produced by the MacArthur Memorial. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at MacArthur1880 or find the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial on Facebook.
Well, welcome everybody. I'm Amanda Williams, and joining me as always is Jim Zobel. And today we have another interesting topic for you. When the United States entered World War I, Douglas MacArthur was a U.S. Army major. About 14 months later, he was a brigadier general. And prior to the war's conclusion in November 1918, he's on the verge of a promotion to major general. Now, that kind of meteoric rise was not too unusual during the war emergency of World War I. You had a lot of wartime promotions in the National Army that included officers like MacArthur, George Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and they're all moving up several grades during the war in that National Army. Now, the exception, though, in this list is MacArthur, because after the war ends, his promotion to major or brigadier general is recognized in the regular army. And so he gets to keep that rank after the war. He will spend the next several decades as a general officer. And today we're going to discuss that rapid promotion during World War I and whether or not these promotions were warranted or perhaps influenced by his family connections. So, Jim, first question. April 6, 1917, United States enters World War I. Douglas MacArthur is a major attached to the Army General Staff in Washington, D.C. He's basically the Army's first public affairs officer. He doesn't want to spend the war behind a desk, though, and he's not going to have to, because in the summer of 1917, he's going to be advanced to the rank of colonel in the National Army, and he'll be attached to the new 42nd Division. Tell us the story behind this first promotion during the war.
Well, it all comes really with Newton Baker, who's the Secretary of War. He was like a two-time mayor of Cleveland. And after Secretary of War Garrison resigned right before the National Defense Act of 16, Baker came in. And everybody thought he was a pacifist, but not really. And he got to be real close with MacArthur almost after about 5 months. And then he assigns MacArthur to run the Bureau of Information for the War Department. And he'll, like you said, he's like one of the first press relations guys, one of the first press censors. And so when the United States gets into the war, MacArthur's really the guy who sells all the newspapermen on the draft, you know, selective service, because they knew they were going to need over 1 million men. They knew they were going to need them quick. And so they decided to institute the draft. And all those congressmen, when they heard the word draft, all they thought was of the draft riots in the Civil War. And so they're real worried about stuff like that. MacArthur has the ability to impart to the journalists, you know, that meet him at his desk every day, the seriousness of the reasons why. And so they, in turn, sell that to the country. And MacArthur's got a lot of sway with them. You know, people always talk about MacArthur using the press. These guys really have a big trust for him. They'll write a 29 of them write a letter to the Secretary of War saying MacArthur's the, you know, the greatest thing they've ever run across, just because he gives them all the information they want. But, you know, he doesn't give them everything. And so when MacArthur does this and really sells the country on selective service, the Newton Baker recognizes, you know, MacArthur's ability even more now. And there's a report going through the War Department from the General Staff just how they want to use the regular army during the war. They don't want to use the National Guard. And MacArthur reads through it and he writes on top of it, basically, you guys don't care what I think. I don't agree with this. And the next person it goes to is Secretary of War. And Baker's like, what are you talking about? And MacArthur says, you're going to need the guard. These guys have been on the border the past 3 years, you know, with the Mexican incursions. You know, let's get them in the green. Let's get them out there. These guys are perfectly capable. MacArthur's thinking about his father, Arthur MacArthur, in the Civil War and the 24th Wisconsin Regiment that was, you know, a makeup of citizen soldiers. And MacArthur believes in that. And Baker basically says to MacArthur, you know, I agree with you. And they go see President Wilson. And MacArthur convinces Wilson of why they're going to need the National Guard. And Wilson supposedly was like, well, thank you, son. And you know, thank you for your candid appraisal of the situation. And then it becomes a thing of who's going to be the first Guard Division, because if your state is the first one to go, then then the state's going to be like, you're sending our boys to slaughter. If they're the last one to go, it's like, you left our boys out of the fight. And so they wonder how they're going to address this problem. And MacArthur and then William Mann, who's head of the Militia Bureau, they get together with Baker and they come up with this idea of using all these individual National Guard units from a bunch of different states and put them under one division. And MacArthur said, okay, great, that'll cover the country like a rainbow. And so that was the creation of the Rainbow Division. And then Baker goes and tells William Mann, who's 65 years old, I want you to run the division and MacArthur's going to be your chief of staff. And Mann was very excited about that. He liked MacArthur. He thought he was a very energetic officer, had a good mind. And then Baker calls in MacArthur and is basically like, I know you don't want to sit behind a desk. I'm going to get you chief of staff of the division of the Rainbow. And MacArthur was, well, you know, I'm not billeted for that. I'm only a major. And Baker was like, well, we're going to take care of that right now. I'm going to get you a colonelcy. And so MacArthur advances over the rank of lieutenant colonel already and becomes a colonel. And Baker says to him, do you want to be a colonel of the engineers, I guess, you know, because MacArthur's an engineer. And MacArthur, no, I want to be infantry. You know, he wants to be like his father. He knows that's the fast track for promotion during war. And so that's when Baker offers him that, he said he was, you know, you could have knocked him over with a feather, but that's what he wants. And so then he'll be this chief of staff for the Rainbow Division. And that's how he becomes a colonel.
And just to clarify, he will never hold the rank of lieutenant colonel in his entire career.
Well, no, passes right over it. And, you know, like you were saying before, it won't visit any of those grades again.
Right. All right. So moving forward, then, he is a colonel. He's attached to the 42nd Rainbow Division. He's its chief of staff. The Rainbow Division arrives in France in November 1917.
Right.
And what's his job? I mean, what is he doing as chief of staff of this division?
Well, the chief of staff basically makes sure that all the orders and everything from the general of the division get imparted to everybody. They, you know, oversee training. They oversee all the different supplies. They oversee personnel. They keep records of everything. And basically, they are to make sure the division gets where it needs to be, is on time for things. And so it's basically running the entire operations for those four infantry regiments, the artillery regiments, your ammunition trains, your field hospitals, everything, controlling that. MacArthur will have a staff under him that he trains to be able to do all that. And when they get to France, immediately the division is split up for training. The artillery goes to Couët-Quidon in the Brittany Peninsula, and the infantry goes to the Toul area, and headquarters goes to Vaucouleurs. And so they're all separated. But as well, when MacArthur gets there, he finds out immediately Pershing gets rid of William Mann. William Mann, 65 years old. He's not gonna make it. He's heavily overweight. MacArthur was really the energy behind getting them all to France. And so when they get there, Pershing immediately gets rid of him and puts in William Menaher, who was his classmate from 85, I think it was. And so now Menaher will be running the division. But as well, then Pershing wants to create a new corps, and he's going to break up the Rainbow and put all their men in different units and break up all the staff. And William Mann is very politically connected back in Washington. So as soon as he gets back, he's, you know, lobbying everybody to keep this division as well. MacArthur goes over everybody's head and sends a telegram immediately to Newton Baker and says, hey, he's breaking up the Rainbow Division. And so Baker immediately goes back to Pershing. That's my division. But MacArthur's also machinating. He has an old friend, James Harbord, that's on the staff at Chaumont of Pershing's staff. And he invites him to come look at the division. And he comes out there, says, yeah, they're untrained, but these guys have got high esprit de corps. They've got, you know, great morale. I don't, you know, think we should break this group up. And as well, MacArthur is also supposedly feeding stories to a guy, a journalist named John Corley, about the Rainbow Division, trying to make sure that they don't get destroyed. So whereas MacArthur earns the affection of of all the people in the Rainbow Division, he's already button heads with John J. Pershing and the entire Chaumont staff as soon as they get to France, basically. And so that's where a lot of this friction will come from the headquarters and MacArthur. And I think it, you know, it resolves itself by the time of the end of the war, but it was just kind of like, who's this upstart, you know, and then people are calling him the show off and mm-hmm. whatnot, but you know, he's not showing off if he's doing everything that, you know, is being said about him. You know, it's kind of like Earl Blake goes back to, you know, there's a guy who will say, I can go out and shoot 10 for 10. And you're like, yeah, shut up. And then they go do it, you know, and they do it every single time. And mm-hmm. that's kind of the way it is. So, MacArthur's, you know, getting a name for himself in that sense, but he's also very effective as what he does. He's a very conscientious soldier and knows his business.
I always think it's interesting that, you know, when he's that young major in Washington, D.C., when he's interested in the National Guard and using it in the war, that is not the key army position on that issue at that point. And yet here's this young major influencing the Secretary of War and the President of the United States. And then flash forward, here he is, this young colonel, and it's not his job to kind of fight for the 42nd to stay together. You know, that's probably the general of the division's job. But here he is going over everybody's head to talk to the Secretary of War, to talk to even politicians, you know, that he knew in his time in D.C. And he's, you know, he's always acting almost kind of at a higher level than technically the rank that he wears on his uniform. But he just keeps doing it. And people keep being OK with that for the most part.
Well, they do get back at him or at the division, so to speak, because MacArthur had you know, garnered a supply, I think, of about 50,000 pairs of or 5,000 pairs of shoes, you know, that they bring over there, and immediately Chaumont takes all those. You can't mm-hmm. have all that. And as well, when they get over there, then they raid all those officers. MacArthur handpicked all these people to be there. And then they take all them. Summerall immediately goes. He'll become first division commander and a corps commander later on. And they'll try to get Wild Bill Donovan and take him away mm-hmm. from the 165th. But MacArthur and Donovan go to Chaumont and say, you know, we can't lose him. We have to mm-hmm. have him. And so in a sense, they raid it pretty well. And that's the way it always is, it seems, with MacArthur in his career. He does things that nobody else does. He's a good officer. He does a great job.
Well, there's repercussions. There's repercussions. You know, the 42nd obviously suffers some of that. But in terms of career, it certainly doesn't impact his ability to climb through the ranks. You know, nobody's ever saying, no, you know, we're not going to promote him, or no, he's not, you know, up for this. So anyways, that brings us to his next promotion. So in the summer of June 1918, he's promoted to Brigadier General in the National Army, and he's still with the 42nd Division. So tell us about the circumstances behind this promotion and what is he doing around this time?
Well, since February, the Rainbow had been in the Lunéville-Baccarat area, and it had been a quiet sector. It had been really bad in the first part of the war, 1920. Lunéville was completely destroyed by the Germans. But at that point, as a quiet sector, the Rainbow gets in there, and they just start going crazy, and it immediately becomes a hot sector once again. MacArthur goes on three raids that we know about, Raye-Chicourt, the Salient de Fays, and one other. He's decorated for all those, the Croix de Guerre by the French and the Silver Star, which, you know, a citation, but he'll also get the Distinguished Service Cross for that Salient de Fays. And so everybody in the Rainbow, and especially Major General William Menaher, they think MacArthur's the greatest. And it's Menaher that advances to get MacArthur promoted, to get him a star. They're in that Lunéville-Baccarat area till about June, and that's when all those spring offensives have been pulled off by Ludendorff and the Germans. And so they pulled them out of that Lunéville-Baccarat area, and they're taking them to the Champagne area. And on June 21st, they're loading the railroad cars at Charmey, and Pershing shows up, and He just lays into MacArthur. And, you know, it's not MacArthur's division. He's the chief of staff still, you know, as a colonel there. And he says, this is the worst division, the most undisciplined division, and it's all your fault. You've got to rectify this. MacArthur, we know, had adopted that style with the crush cap, the sweater, the purple scarf, not really an army uniform. And Pershing saw, you know, who's very much a stickler for appearance and, you know, being brass and polish, he sees the division as following this MacArthur example. Now, we also, you know, and MacArthur didn't understand it. He couldn't understand why Pershing just laid into him the way he did. Well, 5 days later, MacArthur's name is on that promotion list. And we know Richard Frank did some great work that when MacArthur's, when the promotion list came to the chief of staff of the Army, Peyton March, MacArthur's name wasn't on there. And March eliminated three of Pershing's choices and put MacArthur's name in there.
Wow.
And so, you know, what is that the reason why Pershing explodes on MacArthur at Charmey that day? We just don't know. But, you know, obviously he knows what's going on in that sense, because 5 days later, they'll, you know, list MacArthur as being on this Brigadier General list. MacArthur will write Pershing on the 11th of July, I think, after it's made official. And he'll send him the same letter like he sends to Leonard Wood earlier and these other people. We hope that your presence in the AEF will send you to that lofty position, which you deserve, you know, the presidency, always,
right,
you know, greasing them up, so to speak. But at this point, you know, MacArthur and Pershing's relationship is not going the way MacArthur would like it to go. You know, he wants to be well-liked. He wants to be, you know, seen as something really great by Pershing. And I think Pershing, you know, and it's proven later, he does see him as one of his greatest battlefield commanders, you know, but I think Pershing is, in a way, is like MacArthur in World War II. And nobody's going to outshine me while we're over here in France as I am the, you know, supreme commander of the AEF. And so he gets his star and everybody's good with it.
Now, MacArthur biographers often relate how MacArthur's mother, Mary Hardy MacArthur, was friends with Pershing. He had been a family friend and acquaintance for a number of years because of Arthur MacArthur's military career. And they make a big deal of the fact that she was writing letters to Pershing asking after her son, Douglas, but also kind of saying, you know, hey, you know, is he going to be promoted? Hey, you know, he should probably get his first star. Now, do you think any of these letters had an influence on the promotion? I mean, from what you just told me, it sounds like Pershing didn't even have him on the list, didn't put him on the list, but was okay with it after the fact. So, I mean, what do you think that Mary's role in the promotion was?
Well, we know in October of 17, she wrote Newton Baker the same kind of letter of give my boy a star. You know, they haven't even left New York yet and gone over to France. And she's already writing him, you know, to give him a star. And Baker just ignores it. He doesn't write her back. But then Mary Pinckney Hardy moves to Washington and starts lobbying him again, you know, my boy needs a star, you know, and Baker will say, I have nothing to do with that. That's, you know, determined by the War Department or by the chief of staff and by Pershing over there, you know, and gets out of the loop that way.
Right.
We know that she does write Pershing on June 12th of 1918. But everybody says that would have gotten there after they already made the decision. So, you know, it doesn't really have an effect on anything that's done at that time. She was always throughout Douglas MacArthur's career writing people to, you know, further enhance, you know, what he's doing or further his career. Mm-hmm. When she thought he was, you know, not destined for the army, she was writing the Harriman Company to get him a top level job in the railroads back in 1911, 1912. So she was always doing that kind of stuff, you know, and like I always say, everybody should be lucky enough to have a mom like that who's always pushing you. I don't think it has an effect, but we don't know. Did she write Peyton March, you know, who also owed his career to Arthur MacArthur Sr.? But nobody's said that. And the thing is you know, March is the one that really pushes that, and he's the one that will let MacArthur, you know, keep his brigadier generalship, you know, when the war ends. So, the main thrust, I think comes from him.
All right. So MacArthur at this point is a brigadier general. He is, let's see, 38 years old, 37, 38 years old. That's a very young general. I think today, if you're in the service, I think you're trying to calculate this in my head. Lieutenant Colonel is probably what, about 40 years old? So he's a brigadier general already, and he is, you know, very, very young at this point. Now, what are his responsibilities at this point? What is he doing with the 42nd Division? And is he very well liked by the men under his command?
Well, Pershing thought so. You know, like we were saying before, where he thought that the whole division had adopted MacArthur's style. And you tend to like a guy who shows up for the trench raids, you know, who's a bird colonel, doesn't have to be there. And MacArthur is always very keen to be among the troops. They all know who he is. So, yeah, by the division, they think he's the king. And you'll see that in every single book by a Rainbow Division veteran, you know, that comes out. I mean, while Bill Donovan and him might have some conflicts, but these are two very high strung individuals that are trying to make their career in the Rainbow. That first month that he's a brigadier general, he's still the chief of staff. So he's running everything for the division, getting them into the Champagne during the defense there against the final Friedensturm Ludendorff offensive. And then when the Einmarn offensive comes right after that Champagne defensive, when the 1st and 2nd Divisions go in and take Soissons area, then that drive against Chateau Thierry and the Ork River will occur, trying to push the Germans out of that salient. And MacArthur gets the division everywhere they need to be, gets them all in line for what's going to happen. And then he's the chief of staff of that of division still during that massacre on the Ork, which is that's the only way you can call it. They'll lose, you know, a third of the Rainbow Division there. But then on early August, Robert Brown, who runs the 84th Brigade, you've got two brigades in the Rainbow, the 83rd, 84th. Brown is relieved of command because of he was just out of it during that Ork River campaign, and they put MacArthur in as now a brigade commander. So from then until about early November, MacArthur's total concern is the 84th Brigade. William Hughes will take over as chief of staff, and it's crazy because William Hughes was a boy on Fort Selden with Douglas MacArthur when they were both about 5-6 years old. And his memories of Douglas MacArthur range from being in these baskets in Fort Selden pretending to shoot elephants to being all of a sudden on the fields of the Rainbow Division. Just kind of weird the way that, you know, that all worked out. But and even at the end, MacArthur would say to Hughes, "You are my oldest and longest friend," you know, coming in the 1960s. So he had trained him, and now MacArthur will have the 84th Brigade, and the chief of staff will be William Hughes.
Now, towards the end of the war and into the occupation of Germany that followed, there are efforts made by a series of his commanders to secure him a promotion to major general. And they all cite his outstanding qualities of mind, resourcefulness, and leadership. What derails this effort?
Well, this was right after the seizure of the Côte de Châtillon. And this was in the Meuse-Argonne. It was a linchpin of the Kriemhild-Stellau line. It had been tried to take by the 32nd as well as the 1st Division. They got hammered at these places. And then the Rainbow Division came in. And the French had always said, and the Germans even, that the Rainbow were better than any shock troops of the French or the British. And they said that was one of the main divisions in the U.S. Army that they were worried to be up against. And this position is rounded by fortifications, barbed wire, machine guns, everything else. And through a series of 3-day attacks, they, you know, and the working of all the 84th Brigade staff, they come up with a plan to take this position. And it was something that nobody thought was going to happen. And when it does, they put Summerall, who's the Corps commander, puts MacArthur up for the Medal of Honor, but also says he needs to be promoted to Major General as well. William Menaher, commander of the Rainbow Division, says that MacArthur at this point needs to be Major General. This is about October 18th of 1918. October 30th, again, they will make this recommendation and Pershing's all for it. You know, that's what I mean by whatever friction there might have been at the beginning of the war. I don't think it's there anymore. Pershing is all for it. He recognizes MacArthur as, you know, being one of his, you know, great battlefield commanders. He'll say so during World War II as well. And it thing is, though, is Pershing will put MacArthur up for that major generalship in 3 November. And that's only 8 days before war is going to end. On 6 November, they put him in command of the division. They were going to put another major general in there, but Menaher, Summerall, and Pershing were even leave him in there. And so he'll run the division for that month of November. But after the war ends, Peyton March tells Pershing no more promotions. You know, everybody's done being promoted. And so that's what really does it. Nobody squashes it or anything like that. It just, you know, it's a directive from the War Department that, you know, there'll be no promotion. So the end of November, they bring in Major General Flagler, and MacArthur's already gotten the division into Germany for the occupation. And then he'll go back to being 84th Brigade commander at that point.
In 1920, he's confirmed as a brigadier general in the regular army. Why does he get to keep this wartime rank when literally everybody else reverts back to their pre-war rank?
Well, I think it's just circumstances. You know, we always talk about, you know, during MacArthur's career, things just come up, you know, that all of a sudden he's involved with that, you know, make him shine to all these people that he probably didn't to before. And when he comes home from the war, Peyton March is still the chief of staff. And he calls MacArthur in and he says, you know, you've got it. I'm going to send you to West Point. The place is destroyed for, you know, we graduated everybody. All the traditions are lost. I need somebody who's energetic, that's going to be able to go up there and take on that entrenched board of supervisors and board of educators. And you're the guy. And MacArthur was, you know, I'm a soldier. I'm not an educator. And most of the professors there are the professors that taught me when I was there. But March is like, nope, this is what you're going to do. I can feel it. You know, this is the way it's going to happen. And that's why he keeps that star. You know, everybody else reverts back to what they were before. And this is the most important position that MacArthur will get, is that superintendency, because that allows him to keep that star. And once again, it was just a matter of this opportunity came up. March saw him as the key guy. And so he's the one out of everybody that keeps that rank. And like most all biographers say, this was the most important one. This is really what sets him up for everything that will occur after that.
Okay. Well, then I think you just answered my last question. No, that's great. Does he become chief of staff? Does he become that great general in World War II in Korea without this rapid acceleration during World War I? Does World War I basically set him up, make his career?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's hard to say. Everybody saw something in MacArthur, pretty much, you know, all the brass that are on top of him, even before the war, so to speak. So he's definitely an up and comer. You know, I mean, most first captains at West Point are noticed right away by everybody. But, you know, MacArthur's got a certain ability. And, you know, I'll just point to this guy, Henri Gouraud. And he was the commander of the 4th French Army. And he serves with MacArthur during that Champagne Offensive. And it's only a matter of maybe 2 weeks that they're together. And Gouraud will say for the rest of his life that MacArthur was the greatest, most bravest, most capable officer that he had ever met. And Garreau was known as the Lion of Africa. I mean, he was shot by an arrow, you know, early in his career. He was blown up in the first days of the war on the Western Front. At Gallipoli, he was lost an arm, blown up again, you know, walks with a limp. This guy is just a living legend amongst, you know, all French officers. But he says in that 2 weeks, that's what he saw of MacArthur. And the goofy thing is MacArthur doesn't talk about anything that he did during that Champagne defensive. You know, what did they see in that 2 weeks that would make this guy say that? You know, and he doesn't say it later on when MacArthur's chief of staff, he says it, you know, a month later to somebody right. else. So he's got something, you know, MacArthur does, you know, no matter what, you know, and I always call it the goofy stuff because there's a lot of it, but not some schlub.
Pershing's efficiency report for MacArthur, where he basically says, this is my greatest battlefield commander, but he has a high estimate of his own abilities. It's MacArthur in a one line in a sentence. So,
yeah. Well, it's good to have somebody that believes in themselves. You don't want a general that doesn't believe in themselves.
Right. Right. Well, thank you all for joining us. That is all for today. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.